Okay, so let's get started here. Works better when you turn it on. How many people went on the VA tour on Tuesday? Thumbs up. Good time. Any comments you want to share?
Anybody? Have fun driving the wheelchairs and the bikes around. Learn something as well.
Excellent. Good. I'm glad. And the folks at the VA were very happy to have us there as well. So it was good for everybody.
Excuse me? We just had the
I don't think he was overwhelmed. It's hard to tell from him. I don't know that particular patient, so I don't know his situation or how he got injured or why he's there or when he might leave, so I just don't know. But if you want, I can find out. Okay. Mr. Frazier.
So, got the attendance list. For students that are working on team projects, we have a handout for instructions for the rest of the quarter. Make sure you get that. And, of course, we have an evaluation sheet for the presenter today. In addition, there is a sign-up sheet for Tuesday's tour of the mobility and gait analysis lab in Menlo Park. So there's a bunch of drivers. I think we might have enough drivers. If you need to have a ride, please sign up during the break. And we'll have a good time there because we'll see what will we see there.
This is a clinical lab where they do gait analysis with kids with cerebral palsy. A lot of them have walking impairments that they walk differently. A lot of them walk on their toes rather than have a normal gait cycle. And some of this is caused by a neurological situation or a muscular situation. So by understanding how these kids walk, they can come up with a scheme to strengthen muscles or do surgery to get them back into a better walking cycle. So how do they do that? They put marker balls on parts of the legs and hip and ankle, and they have cameras that observe the kids walking back and forth. There's also a force plate in the floor that helps them look at the forces transmitted as they walk over that. So this is the same technology, this reflective ball technology is the same technology that is used to sort of scan players for video games and stuff. So if you've seen them on TV a lot where they have reflective balls and cameras around, they can pick up the image, the position of a particular body part in space in 3D in real time and translate that into the game. So the game character moves exactly like a regular human to make it more realistic. But that first started in gait labs to look at people with walking impairments. So that ought to be pretty neat. So here's the remaining lectures. We're getting down to like just a few more weeks to go, but these are really good lectures, so I encourage everybody to attend. Peter Axelson is coming next Thursday from Nevada. He's a Stanford grad. He's worked on a lot of recreational devices for people with disabilities. He actually created a sport for people with disabilities that is now a part of the Paralympics.
And he'll talk about that a little bit. And then we'll talk a little bit about aesthetics and starting an assistive technology company. And at the very end, Ralph Hotchkiss will come and talk about his efforts in developing wheelchairs in other countries. Very interesting talk. And then on March 11th will be the final presentations. And on Thursday, we'll have an opportunity for all the students to bring their projects in and demonstrate them to other people and get hands-on.
We'll also have a little bit of a
celebration, pizza and burritos and stuff like that,
so that'll be a lot of fun. And we'll fill out the course evaluation as well.
Okay?
Okay, we did this.
So somebody asked about grades, and that comes up when we're talking about the presentations and the reports. So just to review, the midterm report and presentation count for 30%. The presentations, everybody got feedback from all the evaluators, which took a long time to do, so I hope you appreciate that effort. I don't grade them. I just take the numbers and put them in. But anything that you do, that you've done in at the midterm, is what I consider practice. So some people, you know, everybody can improve. Some people have wider possibilities of improvement than others. Let's put it that way. So just because you maybe didn't do very well in the presentation or the report, it doesn't eliminate you from getting an A, okay? You just have to really look at how much you've improved from midterm to final, because all this stuff is practice. You're not going to get better in presenting unless you practice presenting. Same thing with writing. It takes a lot of practice to get better. So these midterm report and presentations are your practice sessions. Okay? Right. The final grade considers everything you've done, your reports, presentations, your participation, that all counts. I look at the whole thing, and I look at, you know, how much you've participated in class as well. So all that comes into play. Almost all the students, if they do a good job, you know, will get an A or an A minus. You really got to sort of mess up to get anything lower than that. And one way you can mess up is by not making up missed lectures. You know, if you don't do that, then that's an issue, because that affects your grade. So for missed lectures, I've added a new option. You still have to review the information that was presented at the lecture. And instead of just writing a summary, you can arrange to meet with me and discuss the missed lecture, and it'll be up to you to lead the conversation. So if it takes you a long time to write things, it may be easier to just talk about it with me. Okay, so both of those are ways to make up for a missed lecture. Any questions about that? Okay. And of course, I'll keep you informed about any missed lectures that you have. So a couple more things. The RESNA Student Design Competition is now open. And for students who have worked on projects and have written a report, your report probably is all you need to enter the competition. Yes, Luke.
So you just had a meeting, though, where you left this. Well, our teaching is allowed to miss one lecture and not make it up, correct?
Yes. Each team can miss one lecture and be excused for that if they tell me beforehand, they meet together as a team to work on their project. So let me know beforehand. But, you know, I just sort of, you know, the lectures coming up are real good, and so you know, in my mind, I wouldn't want to miss the lectures because I know they're going to be good. Okay, so you should consider that you're in the home stretch for your project. You should be have a plan for finishing your project by the end of the quarter. You should maybe have a list of all the tasks that are remaining and assign them to people on your team. Have a timeline, what needs to be done when. If you need to order stuff, you need to order it early to make sure that you'll get it. You have to make sure you have time in case it doesn't work out and you have to redo something. So you need to work diligently from here on out. And it may get hard because I know you have you know, other classes as well, so you need to manage your time a lot. Okay. So you're still welcome to meet with me to and let me know about your progress. I'm always happy to listen to you and answer questions and give you suggestions. And that's not just on your project, but on your presentation. I can look through a draft of your presentation or a draft of your report and tell you what you need to do to make an excellent report. So please don't be shy about doing that. Okay, so Tuesday we'll be going to the
the motion gate analysis lab, and that's actually a part of Stanford Hospital. And if you're right above it, this is what it looks like. So they're off of Middlefield Road. Palo Alto is off here. And I got some terrain maps. So here's Stanford. Here's the Oval. So what you need to do if you're driving is, you know, head out to El Camino and take one of these streets down to Middlefield and make a left. Middlefield, past Willow Road, and Willow Garage used to be right there. So that's where we went last year for one of the tours. But continue down Middlefield, make a left on Linfield, and enter this parking lot. And there's a building entrance right back here that we'll be entering. So I'll send drivers this information so they'll know. Okay. So today, Kurt's going to be talking about autism. So if you have any questions, now's the time to ask. Otherwise, we'll take a short break and get Kurt wired up, and you can come down and sign in and grab your handouts if you haven't done so, and we'll be back in about 5 minutes. Back to me
on Monday. Yeah. What are you at your office?
Yeah, I'll be at my office.
What are you at your office?
Oh, I'm there from pretty much 8 o'clock on.
Okay.
And if I'm not there, you can leave it with in the Glaston office with John. Okay, that'll be a lot of fun.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks.
Here for many years, so even then we were having a little difficulty finding the place. But
this is your water.
Oh, thank you. Yes, they do. What type of application is it? Oh, you always have to talk. Yeah, I know your team. Oh, okay. The woman who is with your program, or they've come out to the agency a couple times to talk about it. I'm trying to think. No, there's another one that actually came out from that's in Cupertino, but. Several of our students used to have to talk on their iPad applications. So it's very prevalent. No, it's a great, I'm pretty sure that application was designed by you, or is there a whole team that works on that application? I'm trying to think, I'm getting confused with another one, but I know your work.
Like I said,
No, that's great. Well, great to have you here. Thank you.
Yep. Just one.
limited consumption.
Might talk a little bit about yourself, since I'm not going to really.
No problem. I will. I have a little intro I'll give that'll move that right along. And establish me with no credibility, and we'll go from there. The Executive Director of the Pacific Autism Center for Education. We're located in Santa Clara, but we have programs run as far as South San Francisco, Hayward, Hollister, and half. We run a variety of different programs from kids as young as 10 months all the way up to 50 years of age across a variety of different programs, some of which are children's programs, children's preschool, a K-12 school, 6 residential homes, and some adult day programming, as well as outreach in the community for parents and others. I've been at PACE for 9 years. Prior to PACE, I spent 17 years in the technology sector. I did my graduate engineering work at the other university in the area, Santa Clara University. So don't hold that against me. But as a result of that, a lot of what we're going to be talking about is a bit more about the social engineering of designs for the Developmental Disabilities Network or autism in specific. So I wanted to get an opportunity to do that. Previously, I have sponsored 2 teams on the previous 2 sessions, and this particular time I told Dave that I wanted to take a break, and then he stuck me in as a presenter. And I didn't realize that there was so much waiting on this in terms of very excellent status that we have to attain. So next time I am going to go back to just hosting teams in the future for a lower accountability. One of the things that the focus really we're going to talk about is less about what is autism or how is autism's prevalence come into play, but more talk about what are some of the challenges associated with autism, and what are some of the ways that people are addressing those challenges through assistive technology and through different ways of social engineering. So we'll look at that as we go forward. One thing that I like to start with is some principles that have helped to guide me in my 9 years of working at PACE, and that's been the elements of, I had the advantage of having working with some Jesuits on a number of different projects, and their social imperatives are really associated with these three words, competence, conscience, and compassion. I encourage you, as you look out at opportunities in the nonprofit sector or development of disabilities, to embrace these kind of principles. I have no doubt that all of you are competent. One of the things that I recognized coming in as an engineer into the nonprofit sector was that the answers are not about finding the perfect solution. It's making the best out of what's available in a limited amount of resources. And one area where you're going to be challenged with a lot of limited resources, be it limited funding, limited availability of reliable technology solutions, it's going to be in the nonprofit sector. But there are a lot of opportunities for growth and development in a number of different areas. One of the things that we're going to talk about, too, is when designing in, and we've worked with this with the two teams that I've worked with before, is really creating solutions that have a degree of compassion and understanding about the population you're serving. And what we're going to focus on here as we talk a little bit more, the solutions for autism are not bound entirely in just creating the greatest widget for the individual who happens to be affected by autism. It's about creating a solution for all those things around the individual that are going to be principal in making the quality of their life more meaningful. So a lot of what we look at is how does a particular solution interact with others in the field, interact with the families, interact with the day programs that they might go to make the solution a much more enriching experience rather than a point solution or a point problem being solved. But we'll take a look at that as we go forward. What we're going to talk about today is understanding a little bit of autism and the autism field. My purpose here is to give you a landscape, a picture of what autism is. I suspect that every one of you has heard autism to some degree. The majority of you may actually even know somebody that's affected by autism. Any sign of people that have a friend or colleague or relative that have autism? So the prevalence is much greater these days than if I had taken that poll in 2000. And we'll talk a little bit about that as well. But also, you know, there's a resurgence of a lot of people asking the question, is the engineer that's sitting next to me in my cubicle autistic? And you get a lot of those conversations about has it gone undiagnosed for many years and it's now just a resurgence. And we'll look at some of those graphs as we go forward here. The next thing, though, what I really want to focus in on is what does it mean to design for solutions of autism? So we're going to spend very little time on the causal effects or the reasons why autism is so prevalent and more look at how it's impacting our society today. Autism, and this is one slide that I like to start with because to say somebody has autism or to voice autism is to say a myriad of different things. Autism is a spectrum. Many of you probably got your first familiarity with autism with programs like Rain Man or movies of that nature, and you associated autism with what is a small fraction of the autism population or the autistic savants. Others, you know, with the prevalence of other movies and media, we see all sorts of different interpretations of autism and autism and its effects on romantic relationships, on business relationships, and different things of that nature. But the most important thing to walk away with is autism is a spectrum. Now, PACE is an organization that predominantly serves the most severe of individuals affected by autism, and that's in both of our adult and adolescent programs, our school program and our adult residential programs. Those individuals have a high degree of behaviors, have a high degree of communication challenges and social challenges. Most of the individuals that we serve are nonverbal. So we see a lot of application of the advantages of technology and non-tech to provide solutions for communication and socialization with the individuals that we serve. Actually, recently with the DSM-5, they've combined the five elements of autism into one, and now it's just rated as one autism. But most people actually have an understanding of autism from either the higher functioning autism, also previously known and still known as Asperger's, or autism. People don't really associate a lot with the other aspects of PDD-ONOS and CDD and Rett syndrome. But you'll also find that combined with autism are a lot of other things, like ADHD and OCD, ED, and other types of disabilities that tend to play in. The point being is that designing for autism often has perfectly good relevance to designing for a lot of other disabilities in the field. The standard definition of autism is a neurodevelopmental disorder affecting, the most important thing is communication, social interaction, and learning in conventional ways. Another way to look at that is communication is often referenced by delayed language, echolalic language, the inability to even speak at all. A great number of our students in our school have no verbal expression at all. The social interaction is one of the ones that's most prevalent with regards to autism. The awkwardness, the literal interpretations, the inability to look people in the eye for the lack of comfort of knowing what their facial expressions exhibit. Sensory motor behaviors are associated in two classifications. Those of you that have perhaps seen individuals with autism, this is called stimming. It's an effect that helps the individual get grounded in their presence, in their state. It's not a bad thing. It's actually a good thing. It's a calming thing for individuals with autism, but it's often reflected poorly in social settings because it just is awkward for people. The sensory motor regulation is one that we're going to talk about in executive functioning, which is your ability to problem solve. And we'll talk about how some of those affects individuals with autism. This is just some statistical stuff with regards to autism. Many of you have heard autism numbers. How many of you have heard 1 in 88, 1 in 50, 1 in 100? If you live in Cupertino, the density of autism in the Cupertino Union School District is 1 in 60. Meaning that one out of every 60 students in the Cupertino Elementary School System is being served under an autism diagnosis. In California in general, 11% of all students in the school, and this is consistent year over year for the last decade, roughly that 11%, are being served under what's called an individualized education plan or a program for their disability. Of that 11%, 1% of that is autism. Of the autism population that is out there, there is no clear statistic as to how many of them are considered higher functioning and lower functioning. But by my measure, about half of them are higher functioning, meaning that they are mainstreamed in regular classrooms and getting social and communication level supports, and they will graduate. The other half will go on to extend their years to 22 years of age, which is what the California system does for people that need an extra support for disability in the education system. This is a graph. Being an engineer, I created this graph. In the past, this graph was animated, and I'd keep it rolling for too long, and it made people sick. So I keep it static. But what's really important about the telling part of this graph is that, and I get to use the green pointer, if you go back into the year 2000 or 2001, the density in California in the education system was just 14,000. Over the years, of over a little decade, it's jumped to 71,000. But the important thing is that autism, for the most part, was seen as a childhood disability. Most of the individuals being diagnosed were children. It stemmed from the emergence of the DSM-4 in 1994 with a better association of autism, and we started seeing children. As of today, those same people are now adults. They're graduating into a world that is grappling with trying to figure out how to support them, how to support them in vocational skill-based building, how to support them in residential and home-based long-term care supports. And that's where the current area of greatest emphasis for a lot of the nonprofits working in the disabilities field is to address adults, that are looking for a better quality of life. Unfortunately, within the state system, the state pays for, the California Department of Education pays for education, and the Department of Developmental Services pays for everything else. But the amount of resources given to a person when they graduate drops to 25%. So all the support they get in the education system are like a cliff, and they drop off as they go forward. So it's really a challenge to get them as much support in the education system before they graduate to give them the highest quality of life as they go forward. Another way to look at this, this is a common question that I get often, is autism really just a real issue, or is it a re-diagnosis that tends to get more prevalent for what people might have diagnosed differently in the past? This shows a pie chart of what the education system was in 2001, and you can see clearly that autism was a small sliver of the overall special education pie at 2%. Over the years, it has eclipsed to what is now 11%. Another area that also has increased is OHI. Anything else over the last decade do you think that you've heard in the press quite a bit about for, as far as disabilities that you think might have been a factor there? No. Good guess. Asthma is a problem. I watch the Spare the Air Days all the time. Any other guesses? Four-letter acronym? Correct. ADHD, and that's encapsulated in the OHI category, which has also seen an increase from 3% to 9%. SLI, as you can see, is specific learning disability. It was kind of a catch-all, and we brought it in to capture some of the autism. The important component here is not to say that there's a re-diagnosis or a better diagnosis for autism, but a better awareness of autism, which has focused a lot more resources in that direction, which opens up an opportunity for this group to recognize new channels of funding, new channels of exposure, and new channels of visibility on new opportunities for building and designing for the field. The other aspect is the regional center, and their numbers, too, have climbed at a 14% growth rate over the year. Just quite simply, people ask, what are the prevailing factors with regards to autism? And wherever you go, it'll be somewhat similar to this. This is the model that autism's cause related to a genetic predisposition, often coupled with an environmental or some level of trigger that ignites the process. Those two things combined are the prevailing factors with regards to autism. Is there a cure for autism? No. Is there a lot of work going on in the genetic realm to identify different genes? There are. Fragile X is one of those, for example, where a gene has been identified. Is there a lot of investigation into pesticides and other things that might be environmental factors? Yes. But, of course, prevailing at this particular time, there's nothing that we could say with great concrete definition has been the cause of autism. But what I want to do now is switch over to design considerations that impact autism. But before I do, want to encourage you to reach out and ask questions as we go along. This is intended to be more interactive. It'll be a lot more lively and exciting as that. If I don't hear from anybody, I'll throw some of my my devices at you. Go ahead.
It seems that people with autism, some of them focus really well, and therefore do very good in jobs. And actually, there's a desire on the part of employers to get to hire people with autism for their ability to focus on things. So it's strange. I don't know another disability that is like that.
Let me leverage off that. So if you get a chance, you can look up a firm called Sempirical. They started by two VCs. They first came to me with a concept about 4 or 5 years ago. And the concept was simply this, is exactly that. Individuals with higher functioning autism or Asperger's have a real keen ability to stay narrowly focused on tasks at an extremely efficient, proficient method. The only thing is that they do require some accommodations in sensory regulatory and the work process to be able to be effective. Sempirical said, well, this not only represents, what this represents is an advantage, a strategic business advantage for us to move forward. They started what's called a B Corp, which is a social purpose corporation. The advantage of B Corps was introduction over the last couple of years. I'm not sure when it first came onto the field. But is that it can produce a product for social purpose, and they're not held obligated to stockholder equity. So they can be more socially minded than fiscally minded with regards to what they produce. This particular group, and it's very popular, you'll see a lot of evidence to this, not just here, but in other locations, where the target market they addressed was technical testing of products. So they developed a testing product. They understood that they could create a certification in testing, and they could get these individuals certified. They can create the environment for them to be successful. And they anticipated that their productivity would be 30-40% better than what the typical peers would be if all things came together perfectly well. And as far as I can tell, they're well on their track. There's a number of other companies, some in Belgium, that have done similar things and have had great success at not only creating a successful business, but keeping a very profitable and exceedingly great opportunity for those individuals, because they are getting paid a more than handsome living wage, and they have a great meaning in their life, and it's a great success story if we can do more of that. Good question. Any other questions on that front?
Does that generally apply to where you provide them an opportunity and they will be focused, or is it more based on if you can find something they're interested in that's productive for you?
It's a very good question. I think that for anybody who's working, you have to be interested in what you're doing. And you have to have some sort of motivator. So that's an important part of it. The other complication, though, or where you run into some difficulties in these arenas, is because these individuals are so narrowly focused, you need somebody to help coordinate multiple task products. So if you're working with five people in a team, you have to have somebody that helps facilitate what each one of those is doing, because cross-communication on a social level doesn't actually work as naturally as it would in other design environments. Does that make sense? So you have to be careful about how you lay out the framework of the way in which they work. But again, it is very much an important attribute of whether or not they're motivated to be doing that. But we've seen a lot of really extreme talent or quality talent in the areas of math and sciences, obviously, architecture and graphic design and music. And in fact, another one of my favorite little projects was one we did with Google. It must have been 7-8 years ago. They acquired a company out in Colorado called SketchUp, or they created a product called SketchUp, which is an online graphical development model. And it was their real interest to open it up to individuals with autism so they could exercise an expression of graphic design. And some of the individuals that participated in that platform made some of the most intricate and fascinating industrial or blueprint designs of different products, because they have a real knack for images and visual structures. We'll talk a little bit about that as we go through and we talk about some of the design considerations for autism and the importance that visual structures play in the way that we work with individuals in the field. Any other questions? Don't hesitate to interrupt if you can. I deal well with hecklers. So one of the first things that I want to highlight is the field of sensory regulation. One of the big things about individuals with autism is the overwhelming sensory input provided by all of your senses. Right now, a lot of you are benefiting from the fact that most of that sensory distraction that's going on around you is being filtered out. You're not affected by the air conditioning, the flickering of the lights, the temperature changes, or anything of that nature. But imagine if that was not the case and everything came in at the same pace. Most likely, it would drive you nuts and you'd want to retreat to a calmer place. So oftentimes what we find ourselves doing, and again going back to some of the provisions that we make, is providing sensory locations within a school or within the within some frame structures that allow people to block out a lot of that senses, whether it's wearing a headset, whether it's providing some barriers of a break from visual distractions and other things as they go through. But when we talk about things like this, some of the areas where some design concepts can really come into play is some of the things, when you talk about sensory, we're talking not just about what comes in, but what goes out. A lot of the students that we work have no idea how hard they hit. I know how hard they hit, because I have the bruises to prove for it. But building an ability to do that is a design consideration. You can create something that gives individuals tactile feedback that can tell them whether or not they're hitting hard or lighter. And over time, through positive behavioral reinforcement, they can start to understand the level of impact that some of those senses might have. It also comes with screaming or loud talking, not really understanding how that's impacting their communication and their socialization, which plays to their ability to continue to have meaningful relationships with people that they don't hit or yell at as they go through. But sensory is a big thing. You'll see a lot of it with regards to perseveration on 60 hertz lights and different things of that nature, which becomes a big design consideration when laying down a framework of a place where you can make it conducive for individuals with autism to be successful. This is what I mentioned earlier. A lot of our students, again, working a little bit more on the severe level, deal quite a bit better with visual structures, visual learners. If you look back at the prior slide, this is a very popular technique in our school program. It's visual structures. It gives the day every 15 minutes of the day, and it's a visual take on what's next. For those individuals that do have any verbal communication, using a thing called picture exchange communications, or PECs, or visual language is very popular. If you go out and you look at applications or iPad apps for autism, a good number of them focus predominantly on creating visual icons for communication strategies. I was talking to a gentleman here earlier who has a firm out in Cupertino called Tap to Talk, which has an application for an iPad app that does just that. And is one of the applications actually that some of our students in our school use today to help them communicate in the nonverbal world. But the important thing here to think about when you're talking about visual communication strategies is the importance of visual mapping and learning. One of the projects that I worked on here with an earlier team was a project about social-emotional development. That's a big factor that we talked about earlier. And we worked on an application that would map social emotional expression in the face. So imagine, for example, when I have a conversation with you, and if I'm smiling and we're having a good conversation, and you reflect that's a good conversation, the next time we meet, there's a good chance that you'll make a quick association that the prior meeting was a good thing and have a favorable response to meeting me. I hope that would be the case, because we had a favorable expression and a favorable exchange to go with it. But imagine, for example, an individual with autism, that they don't make that connection. They don't understand the association between that favorable expression and what is going to be a good social exchange. So a lot of what our students have to do is understand how expressions, what they mean. So they have to memorize what expressions are, be it sad faces or happy faces. And we did a project that was kind of like a memory mapping game. Showed pictures of happy and smiling faces and frown faces and making the association of what was happy, what was sad. It was interesting as we worked through the project, because the one thing that came out of it is that when we did images that were smiling or frowning, our students were very easy to pick it up. But the moment you switched eyes have an expression too, all things kind of went to hell. The problem with autism, though, is that we have a lot of subtleties in their expression. So I could smile at you and say, idiots, and that kind of breaks down that whole experience. The other problem with behavioral stuff is once an individual has a bad experience, they are 10 times less reluctant to engage in it again from all the students that we've worked with. This is just a very important thing that I like to highlight. And it's one, when you're looking at design considerations, that change is very difficult for individuals with autism. Their structure of their day, the continuity, gives a lot of our students the comfort to know what's happening. It's really important with the programs we run that when we identify a task, we identify what's going to happen next. It's called an if-then sequence. So that if we complete this task, then we're going to do something else. Because having started a task, the anxiety starts to build very quickly as to what happens after the task. If you don't know what's coming after the task and you don't have the associations that understand that there's going to be a sequence from a past experience to get you there, it's really important that your day is structured in that fashion. We have very structured days. Even individuals with higher functioning autism also too thrive on structured days. The problem with structure is if it's too structured, you introduce rote behavior and OCD, and then you get the same compulsive nature every day. Behavior is a big aspect of working through through elements, and this is something where I talk about the community, because a big part of understanding autism is being able to quantify it or being able to identify the occurrence of autism. And what we don't see a lot of in the field is a lot of work done on devices that can help grab that data in a seamless fashion so as to not pull away from the experience of engaging with the individual with autism. One very popular methodology is called applied behavior analysis, which is all about data tracking. The moment you pick your nose, we're going to mark it down. The moment you're going to spit or hit. And the act of having to pull yourself away and write it down on a chalkboard or a data tracking device takes away from the experience that you're having with the individual. And that becomes somewhat problematic. And we go through, but developing a better data tracking mechanisms is another possibility of some design innovation in the field. This goes back to, again, visual learners and the visual command of being able to sequence through the day in a visual mindset. Again, also along with nonverbal is body language and being able to understand and develop platforms for body language. We also had another project that we worked with another team here using the Kinect box. I think there is a group here that's already using the Kinect as well, one group here. Great, one of my favorite platforms to use. It has so much versatility in the possibilities of it. But this was one where we used the whole body to come forward with an avatar to allow for our students to be able to understand how to do a proper exchange for hello and sequencing. And so we had a number of different expressions of the body that came through, whereas before we just had facial expressions and emotions. And that was a very compelling platform. Also with that same platform, they also give the opportunity for 3D modeling. So a lot of those students, whether it's with autism or not, that have fine and gross motor skill issues, being able to map that and show progress is a big attribute to allow them to better their opportunities. Yeah.
You're talking about allowing the Kinect Autism to 3D modeling. So would it be helpful if you could create a program that would essentially teach them what it would look like if they were to say, "I have trouble with that," and then kind of memorize that emotion? Would that be something that would be helpful to them or not?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, that's exactly it. Rather than matching what you see before you, but expressively requesting people to smile and be able to match it is great. The other thing, my dream application would be one where we have so many of our students with gait problems and walking problems and physical problems that we work on a lot of occupational therapy and physical therapy with them, but we never really have a good gauge as to how much progress they're making. The 3D modeling aspects of the Kinect can actually model all the pivot points, and we can start to map that and progress that over time and potentially get an avatar to show them how to do it properly and to work on what they've done and kind of make these modulated changes and watch progress in that way. A little bit more of a sophisticated project than for us, of course, but a great opportunity nonetheless. I already talked about the challenges with face-to-face interaction. I will tell you one anecdotal story that was interesting. A few years back, we started a project for photography, and we introduced video and photography to our students. And we asked them to take pictures of things. And a lot of our students have real serious challenges with looking at people face-to-face. We're always trying to cue for facial expressions. What was interesting, take a guess as to what they took the pictures of most. Close. Faces. We got more people taking pictures of faces because when put behind an impartial medium, they didn't feel as threatened by trying to make out what the people were expressively saying in their faces and their communications. And it was fascinating how many facial pictures we came back with. So that's what got us thinking, well, maybe what if we do teleconferencing and some other things? Will that help our students to better engage in social communication. So these are a lot of kind of the projects that evolve and allow us to improve the quality of life of students by using some of the simplest of onboard technology that's available today. We're not going to spend too much time on this, but I do want to highlight this particular picture, and I want to focus in on this one too. This particular consideration is an individual that's using an iPad to type out a sequence of words for which the iPad will then vocalize what his words are. Now the problem that this individual is having is that they don't have the fine motor or the strength to manage that typing, so they have to always have somebody to assist them in doing that. It's called assisted communication strategies. Now, that's great if you have somebody who can assist you all the time, but this instructional aide can't go around with this person for the rest of their life and then do this, and is only available during the school hours. So this is something where developing up a mechanical arm or some flexibility to give that necessary response, tactile response, it's another opportunity to develop expressions for a lot of individuals, and this just doesn't apply to autism. It applies to a lot of disabilities where people want to be able to communicate. This individual can communicate in full thoughts and figures, and yet he can only do that with the assistance. Yeah.
Okay. Does this lead into something like facilitated communication?
I am all too familiar with that term. All right, so let me touch base on that real quick. So they're talking about a facilitated communication, which is a little bit different. This is, in fact, not facilitated communication. We're very careful on that. Facilitated communication was developed, I think it was out of Syracuse, and what it's designed to do is it has a little bit more of a, I don't want to say the wrong word, let's just say, a symbiotic relationship between the aide and the individual, and in which case it's more than just support with the finer gross motor skill issues. It has to do with a relationship that's built up, and oftentimes it's been ridiculed across the board by the American Association of Hearing and Impairment, ASHA, because oftentimes people say it's not the individual that's doing the typing, it's the aide that's supporting in that endeavor. But again, if you had a mechanical, non-thinking mechanical device, that could really debunk that pretty quickly, couldn't it? So please come out with that so we can get the facility communication thing debate settled quickly. The other, this is a big thing with regards to for design considerations when you're talking about autism, is the importance of modeling, of repetitive modeling, getting to a point of rote behavioral response is critical for a lot of our students because they have a difficulty in remembering sequences over time. And number nine, we're going to talk about a little about, we did another project again with some other people with regards to social story development. This is a fun one when we talk about the use of iPad or other development options, where basically a lot of the learning is done through social stories or block modeling that tends to be very receptive to a lot of our students, again, when they look at visual learning. So this is another opportunity to create social story developments that not only helps the individuals with autism, but also the families and others to get to know and understand things better, which led us to the final one, and this gets back to the original conversation that I had at the very beginning, that the best solutions when looking at autism are the ones that involve the entire community around the individual so that they can afford a better opportunity for communication. And one of the hardest things for us is when we have a lot of students that have iPad apps for communication, when they graduate, I can guarantee you that the adult day programs and places they go do not know how to use those iPads or cannot help facilitate them, and they essentially lose all of their communication and their vocabulary in day one, and they get relegated to a much less quality of life. So where we can find avenues that can create independence and choice and build opportunities for expression that can be utilized and embraced by all members of the community around an individual, the better off that individual will have a lifetime supply of quality going forward. So we really are trying to stress upon the importance of creating solutions that all parties can involve themselves in, either that it's low cost enough so that it can be located in multiple locations, or it's easily understood that we can easily adapt to it. One of the most discouraging things when I came onto this field was the use of AAC devices, $5,000 and $10,000 Dynaboxes and things of that nature. And we had purchased them, the school district had purchased them, but they were never able to get beyond the default screen because even the speech therapists and occupational therapists didn't know how to program them. They were nothing better than doorstops beyond the default screen. Now, I have a personal passion for that because one of the first things that I did in my engineering career was I developed one of the first tablet computers back in the late 80s, which I'm proud to say is now in the Computer History Museum. So if I don't feel old, let me tell you. Grid systems, yeah. Are you familiar? Yeah. Grid systems. So, we never made it big like the iPad. So, anyway. We did, and we made it on a couple of yachts. Some of the America Cup yachts had the tablet computer. That's my claim to fame. But anyway, that was another life in prior times. The other interesting story, if I will add just one more story, is cultural sensitivities. One of the things that I mentioned before was the prevalence of autism in Cupertino. One out of every 60 individuals. If you go down the Guadalupe River a few miles and you get into Allen Rock or the San Jose area, the incident rate for autism is 1 in 205. The national average is somewhere around 1 in 88 or 1 in 100. Now, why is that? We're not talking about a big distance, and we know that the water isn't different. The reason is that it's a different community. The community in Cupertino is a higher socioeconomic class of predominantly a lot of Chinese that have gone beyond the typical stereotype of sheltering in their individuals, their disabilities in the family, and they embrace it. They have probably one of the strongest social groups, nonprofits, for that entire demographic community, and they're very well informed and very knowledgeable about the resources. In Allen Rock, it's a different demographic. It's a Vietnamese community that's largely lower in the socioeconomic class, and they have a great fear of the school system or the government influencing their family lives. And so their prevalence of autism is much lower. But we thought about that, and we said, but one place that that community does embrace, without question, is, any guesses? Which one? No, I mean one place that they go to, one entity, one agency that they don't have any questions about trusting.
Church.
I heard it, absolutely. So we started developing autism education through the church and watched how quickly it was embraced in getting those services out to those individuals. In some cases, I mean, it was really a meaningful experience because those families found it so much more impactful for them if their child could meet one of the church milestones than if they ever got to graduate from high school or anything of that nature. So one of my points about this is when designing product, whether it is for autism or another sector, understanding your audience is really important because in this particular case, if you happen to open up the design of your configuration to allow for faces of individuals that come from the same ethnic background or the use of Vietnamese language or Chinese language in your context, it can open up a lot more doors of some real value to different social and cultural communities. So let me take a minute to... my information is on the slide set that you can get. I can say one thing, though, that we can talk all day long about autism. We can talk about some of the effects. One of the most impactful things you can get is to actually see it in action, to come to see the school, to visit. And if that's ever an opportunity for you, I encourage you to stop in and say hello. It is a real eye-opener in terms of thinking about ways in which you can be an impact to a program when you just throw yourself into it and see how it's operating. So let me stop there and ask, Dave, do you have any questions?
I was going to ask how you're funding.
Very good point. Because the other thing, when I was thinking about this presentation, I was thinking that, you know, one of the most important things that I would say to you is that if you don't have any money, you can't get a lot done. And when you're talking about nonprofits, it's very important that you have good business models in the working that you do. We are funded, our education is funded entirely by the California Department of Education. We are a $9.6 million operation. Our school serves 49 people with 78 staff, to give you an idea of how intensive it is. Every one of the students almost in that school is served with a one-to-one aide that works with them on a daily basis. Our residential homes are funded by another department that doesn't quite have the same funding as the California Department of Education, called the Department of Developmental Services and a regional center system. And that provides for all the support services for people with residential care, for after 22 adult care, adult day programming, in-home behavioral support services, and a lot of the work being done for children under the age of 3. Outside of that, I raise $750,000 a year to help create the offsets of the needs that we have and provide us with opportunities to build new innovative products as we go through. So it's a lot of money and a lot of moving parts to make this level of support viable. Good question. Well, you know, one of the things that if you followed 60 Minutes, you know, autism is cured by the iPad, and you know, so much emphasis from parents comes through and says, you know, I want an iPad, I want an iPad, I want an iPad. Yet their children and their adults work so much better with non-technical solutions, because we have, I mean, when we talk about sensory regulatory, some of this stuff we take for granted, but it's, my colleague, obviously I didn't, it's been a long time since I played baseball. You know, this is, you know, things like that, visual structures, you know, looking at timers that have a visual designation as to when the time is up. We see a lot of this stuff.
Hello.
Really simple devices that allow some of our students, if you take it to a more expanded level, you get full boards like this. The reason why these things are so appealing is they can get dropped and they can survive. And it's really easy for the parents to interchange them to a new data set going forward. Now, some of the applications are getting better, and they're getting, you know, on an iPad and everything else. But I just had a smashed one I was going to bring with me, which I can't tell you how many of my iPads have turned into Frisbees. And that's another design area of a great amount of effort is creating a robust and durable case for the iPad or the Android or the Mini or anything else. And that's a whole market industry in itself, if you go out looking at that. The other thing is that what a lot of people don't see is that this is very simply. This is what a lot of our students work with. It's Velcro and laminate. We go through a lot of lamination and Velcro to make it easy for some of our students to get through the day and work through their sequencing. And then you find all sorts of stuff, but, you know, also, this is what you're going to get with the occupational therapy realm, with a lot of our students that have difficulty with manipulatives. They've got supports for pencils and different things. Medical, so I won't throw this one, but you're more than welcome to come up and take a look at this stuff. It was just stuff that I grabbed around to kind of give some ideas about some of the kind of lower tech kind of solutions that are out there as we look and we go forward. So any other questions from anyone? I want to leave some time open for a Q&A. Yes, please.
So, given that schools are all saying that every kid's with autism, is it like, have you seen that they perform better if they're around people with autism, or is it pretty difficult if they're, like, are they, like, trying to compete more, or is it because they're with other autistic students, they're less prepared?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, and it speaks to something called inclusion, or reverse inclusion, which is the ability to take individuals that are in a developmental disabilities realm and bring them back into a social realm to get them, what we want to ultimately do, get them mainstream, get them back into an educator's format. And absolutely, in a lot of cases, what we've exhibited when we have schools working with individuals with disabilities is a natural mentoring or a natural caring that goes on. That has a lot to do with the type of guidance being done in some of the school systems, because it's so easy to turn that into bullying and manipulation in another realm. But where we do have even some individuals that are working with lower functionings in our own school that are using mentoring to help them along. So I think, I mean, I'm a big proponent of getting inclusion in as much as we can. That's what's ultimately going to happen when you graduate. You're going to be in the community, and you're going to be able to interface, and you want to feel comfortable with interfacing with as many people as you want. But when you're looking at a school that only has 49 people, it makes it kind of inclusive. So what we have is we have 19 bands, and we roll our students out into the community as much as we can to do modeling in the community. And that's such an integral part of the program that we run. So if you live in the Santa Clara area, you'll see a lot of our vans running around, or we go on longer trips too. That's the logo up there. Any other questions? Please. I love equestrian therapy. There's nothing more exciting than to watch some of our children's group homes get on top of a two-ton horse and ride it with confidence. You know, and it's just amazing to see. There's a number of great horseback ranches that are involved in providing that services for the disabilities. Big fan. You have a couple of questions?
You mentioned how the horseback schools go until they're 22 years old.
Yes.
Is it a difficult transition going to like an adult school or going to homeschool for staying home?
From when they hit 22?
Yeah.
Huge. It's huge. And I'll tell you a sad story as related to that. In Sunnyvale, a couple years ago, an individual graduated from the nonprofit school just up the road from us, and went home, but the parent couldn't find an appropriate day program. He graduated in December. By March, she killed herself and her son in the home in Sunnyvale. So that's an extreme case, but it puts a tremendous amount of burden on parents in coping with how to structure a day if you can't find a good adult day program to go to. One of the most memorable things for me in this line of work is in my first year when a parent came up to me and said, "I'm afraid to die because nobody's going to be there to care for my son." And that has stuck with me, and unfortunately that is not the only time I've ever heard of that. I hear that almost every couple of weeks now, because more and more parents are getting on in their years, a lot of baby boomers, and they just don't have a lot of hope that they have a long-term support for their son or their daughter to go forward. So it is difficult, and it opens up a huge need for creative thinking on how we can build better transitional services and better supports for adults in the field, without question. There was one more question over here real quick. I want to be mindful of the time. Yes. Absolutely. I mean, the more support that's available, the more people are going to be able to take advantage of that. Do I think that the prevalence of autism is because the numbers are bigger here than other places? Doesn't mean that there aren't autism elsewhere. Absolutely not. I mean, there's going to be the same prevalence throughout. But the awareness of it is certainly opening up opportunities for people to get the support they need. The more fine type of support that provides the better structural support to get them for autism versus being stuck in a regular, you know, heterogeneous developmental disabilities arena where they're getting kind of the standard run of special education support. Good question on that point. All right, I want to be mindful, Dave.
Right, it's 5:30 now, so I think we should thank her for that.
Thank you. And if you want to... if you want to talk more about autism, you have my information. Be happy to have a tour, show you around, go a little deeper. Thanks, Steve.